It took 15 months of its war on Gaza, but the Israeli military has finally figured out the obvious. Having your soldiers posting evidence of war crimes on social media and celebrating them comes with consequences, legal ones.
Work with President Trump.
Mark Zuckerberg and Meta cave in anticipation of Donald Trump's return to the White House. And what does Trump administration number two have in store for legacy media outlets? Where does mainstream journalism in the U.S. go from here? The October 7th attacks by Hamas and Israel's genocidal response have shaken several Middle Eastern countries to their foundations. That includes Israel itself, where the news media provide a window into a nation initially gripped by grief that then turned to revenge. That picture, however, has started to shift. At the liberal end of the Israeli spectrum, expressions of guilt, even anger over the onslaught in Gaza have been surfacing, with more and more Israeli voices using terms such as ethnic cleansing, even genocide, to describe it. And there is alarm over how Israel's devastation of Gaza may come home to roost, sparked by the news that Brazil launched an investigation into an Israeli soldier on holiday there for war crimes, and the implications that has for hundreds of other soldiers who have incriminated themselves on social media, which is why 46,000 Palestinian lives later, the Israeli army has now taken extraordinary steps when it comes to both the mainstream media and social media to stop showing the faces of its homegrown war criminals. Four interviews on the genocide Israel continues to inflict on Palestinians in Gaza. Two from Israel, done over Zoom, since Al Jazeera has been banned there. One from the U.S., and one with a Palestinian human rights researcher in central Gaza. What is left of it?
We're talking about 80% of the population that even if they were allowed to go to their homes, they will not actually find homes. They will live on the rubble. This suffering will continue for decades, not just years, decades.
Despite all the evidence, much of it posted by its own soldiers on social media, Israel still insists it's not committing war crimes, let alone a genocide. But more and more countries see past the propaganda. Like Brazil, where a judge recently ordered that an Israeli soldier on holiday there be investigated for his role in Gaza. The Israelis got him out before charges could be laid. The case produced a panicky response in Israeli news studios because of its implications.
Argentina, Chile, Brazil, מדינות שיש להם סמכות שיפוט אוניברסלית ומאוד קל להעמיד, וכמובן תאילנד, יעד פופולרי שמחפשים שם משרד עורכי דין, וזה כנראה ילך ויגבר, אבל...
Army chiefs then declared that from now on, the identities of Israeli soldiers will be hidden from the world, their faces blurred in interviews, plus a ban on soldiers posting their exploits on social media. It's too little, much too late. Soldiers have already provided mountains of online evidence for war crimes investigators, which, as a former Israeli Army Chief of Staff pointed out, is not the only evidence out there.
שיפסיקו להוציא החוצה כל מיני סרטונים וכל מיני אמירות, אבל זה לא יעזור להם, הפוליטיקאים ידברו על זה שבעצם אנחנו מתכוונים לדלל או לנקות האוכלוסייה, זה פשע מלחמה, אז לא?
The Israeli news outlet Ya'alon was speaking on, Ynet, has since posted an online guide for Israeli soldiers on how to avoid arrest overseas and what to do if that happens.
Their own soldiers have been taking to social media, going on Instagram, going on TikTok, and posting videos of war crimes. So part of the reason why Israel is in this crisis is because their own soldiers have been going onto social media and broadcasting their own war crimes.
The fact that there has been an article in one of the mainstream Israeli web portals saying, here's a guide for reservists about how to protect yourself when you go abroad so you don't fall under threat of prosecution. This is a kind of mind-boggling thing that Israelis didn't really ever have to worry about, but those kinds of efforts to prosecute them have only been possible when those very same soldiers themselves have incriminated themselves in war crimes.
There's been an explicit push to delete social media posts, certain things you shouldn't say in public, which is rather startling because instead of saying, if you think they are war crimes, you shouldn't partake in them, you should refuse, the push is, this is how you should hide them. The shame isn't translated into taking action in refusing to partake in the genocide, but rather to sort of be ashamed that the world sees us in this position. We should hide it better.
Other changes in the Israeli media space include some of the terminology now seeping into the debate. That ex-Army Chief of Staff, Moshe Ya'alon, set off shockwaves in early December by openly calling Israel's tactics in Gaza ethnic cleansing.
או ללכת בדרך שכרגע גוררים אותנו, לכבוש, לספח, לטהר טיהור אתני, תסתכלו על צפון הרצועה.
As if emboldened by Ya'alon, a collection of center-left voices has since followed his lead, some of them injecting another taboo term, genocide, into the discussion. International audiences have been hearing such terminology for months, a problem the Israeli government is now spending more money on. It has made a dramatic increase to its Hasbara or propaganda budget, allocating another $150 million to target the foreign press, social media platforms, and college campuses, treating the symptoms rather than curing the disease.
I don't think the start of improving Israel's image is to write a nice message, to trot out the right people who look earnest in conversation abroad.
The thing that the Israeli government wants more than anything is to bring back our people.
I don't dismiss the necessity of communication, but it has to start from a genuine change of reality and political policy.
In terms of the amount of money, $150 million increase to what they were already going to spend on public diplomacy, it just underscores the extent of the crisis here. You can't put lipstick on a pig, and no amount of money spent on public diplomacy is going to be able to erase all of these images that people have been seeing now on social media.
The circular relationship between Israel and the world is such that Israel does something objectionable or criticizable, and then the world criticizes it, and then Israel cries anti-Semitism.
The singling out of the one and only Jewish state.
And then Israel invests in money and effort just to show the world why actually the world is anti-Semitic and it is always right. Israel is just investing all its efforts into changing its image rather than rethinking its actions.
All of this is unfolding as Israel presses on with its attacks on Gaza, including what remains of its hospitals and media corps. The day after Christmas, five employees of Al-Quds, a TV news outlet affiliated with Palestinian Islamic Jihad, were killed in an airstrike, the worst massacre of journalists of the entire war. Babies forced to live in tents are succumbing to hypothermia, freezing to death. Ceasefire talks have resumed, but there is little to no reason to believe that Israel will meet Hamas's demand for a full withdrawal from Gaza.
קוראים לי ליריאל בגה, אני בת 19, כלומר מעל 450 ימים.
The pressure on Israel to return to the negotiating table intensified last weekend after Hamas released a video of one of the few dozen captives said to be still alive, a 19-year-old named Liri Albag.
Liri Albag has been one of the more prominent hostages in the Israeli consciousness because her family have been very outspoken. In the video, she's like a shell of a human being in very poor physical condition. Hamas has been releasing these kinds of videos to generate public demands towards a ceasefire deal. The Israeli government call it psychological terror. Israelis don't care what you call it. The growing majority are willing to end the war for the sake of getting the hostages back.
The video of Liri Albag hasn't been broadcast in Israeli mainstream media in its full. The use of uniform here is supplied by Hamas. It's to remind Israelis that she is a soldier. It's a reminder of the contradictions of the deep militarism of Israeli society that sends 19-year-old girls to serve in the military, but then still treats them as young women, like they're still the vulnerable young women that they actually are. It is incredibly hard for all of us to watch these videos.
On the captives, there's another much larger group that gets minimal Israeli or international attention. The Palestinians rotting away in Israeli jails in their thousands. A wildly disproportionate amount of the focus goes to the dozens of Israeli captives who have yet to be brought home. And away from the bigger picture, the genocide in Gaza, a population now made up almost entirely of refugees, living in tents as Israeli bombs keep raining down in places like Deir al-Balah.
Deir al-Balah now houses more than 1 million Palestinians concentrated in this pretty much refugee camp. It's very dangerous. The smallest bomb dropped on any neighborhood in Deir al-Balah can result in a massacre. This genocide on Gaza, it was never about only releasing the hostages. Israel wanted to teach the Palestinians a lesson to destroy the whole of the Gaza Strip. And even if Israel were to agree to a ceasefire deal now, the attacks will continue on Palestinians in the whole of Palestine.
Some of America's corporate big boys are tripping over themselves, trying to curry favor with Donald Trump and his incoming administration. But few companies have been as active and as blatant as Mark Zuckerberg's Meta. Meenakshi Ravi is here with the details.
Keeping up with the pace of change at Meta since Trump's election victory has become something of an endurance sport. The latest announcement from Chairman and CEO Mark Zuckerberg was significant, not just because of the content of his statement, but the very obvious tone of deference towards Trump.
The recent elections also feel like a cultural tipping point towards once again prioritizing speech.
According to Zuckerberg, Meta's fact-checking and content moderation had gone too far and had resulted in censorship. So, professional fact-checking will be replaced by users flagging and correcting inaccuracies. Restrictions on contentious topics like immigration and gender will be lifted. And Zuckerberg went further.
We're going to work with President Trump to push back on governments around the world pushing to censor more.
There's been reams of analysis on the changes coming to Meta. The broad consensus is that in an era of accelerating disinformation, there is reason to be very concerned. It's not that all the changes are bad. For instance, the user-based approach to flagging inaccuracies is more open and democratic than outsourced content moderation. Also, no one is arguing that Meta's platforms don't have a censorship problem. However, this is a blatant pivot by Zuckerberg. Back in 2021, Meta issued an indefinite ban on Trump after he instigated the January 6th riots. That ban was lifted in 2023, and since Trump's re-election, Meta has made a $1 million contribution to Trump's inauguration celebrations. Zuckerberg dined with Trump at his Florida resort, and there have been changes to senior staffing, with Republicans being swapped in at the board level. All of this looks less like Zuckerberg is restoring free speech and more about big tech making nice with the White House.
Thanks, Meena. And big tech is not alone in preparing for a second Trump term. Across the U.S. media landscape, there is a mix of anticipation and concern. For the pro-Trumpers, right-wing channels like Fox News Nation and online outlets, the, quote, free speech express will give them a lot more space. The rest, ranging from never-Trumpers to skeptics, are braced for impact. During his latest election campaign, Donald Trump attacked the media more than 100 times, took news outlets to court, and threatened to pull the licenses of broadcasters he does not like. With just days remaining before his second term, we spoke with three journalists about how they are preparing. All of our attempts to interview conservative voices and commentators failed. They either did not respond or refused to be filmed. Here is what those who did agree to talk to us had to say about Trump, the sequel.
Perfect. Yeah. Right in there.
My first question is, how are you feeling on the cusp of Trump term two? Are you braced? Are you determined? Or are you exhausted already?
I feel as committed, galvanized, curious, extremely serious about what's going on today as I ever have. Our role as journalists is to hold those in power accountable. That was our job under Biden. It's our job under Trump. And we have a lot of work to do, to say the least.
You know, I mean, it's a great story. I think a lot of reporters, the ones who aren't totally burnt out at this point, are very energized by it, because I think nobody knows what's going to happen.
I don't know that I'm feeling all that differently about the job of journalism from the way I was feeling about it before the election. I do think that, though, that this is a moment of real introspection for journalists as a whole. We have to think about why some of the stories that we published about Trump didn't really reach voters or weren't taken seriously by voters.
Even that enemy, too, when they're really the enemy, they're the enemy of the people, the press.
Trump hasn't even been sworn in as president yet, but he's going after the media in a way that's unprecedented.
To get me, somebody would have to shoot through the fake news. And I don't mind that so much.
He's also suing news outlets. He took ABC News to court because one of their star anchors, George Stephanopoulos, said Donald Trump had been found guilty in a civil trial of rape.
Donald Trump has been found liable for rape by a jury.
Now, what he'd been found guilty of was sexual assault, but the judge said that in common parlance, it would be known as rape. So many legal experts said the ABC lawyers could have defended it and won. But Disney Corporation, which owns ABC, has a lot of interests it wants to pursue during the Trump administration, and clearly they didn't want to squander any political capital on this. When wealthy media organizations fold in the face of a lawsuit from Trump, it makes it easier for him to sue again, which is what he immediately did.
President-elect Trump has sued the Des Moines Register and its retiring star pollster Ann Seltzer over a poll that had Vice President Harris ahead of him in Iowa. Trump ultimately did win Iowa. The suit argues the poll constituted election interference.
This poses a real danger. Trump and his team are going to step up their legal offensives against the media, and there need to be media outlets willing to take on these challenges and defend their work.
And we'll probably be filing a major lawsuit against them today or tomorrow. We're filing one on 60 Minutes, you know.
This country is going through a crisis of media and information worsened by the stream of lies and disinformation that people like Donald Trump and Elon Musk push out all the time. Billionaire media owners like Jeff Bezos at The Washington Post, Patrick Soon-Shiong at The Los Angeles Times, and social media magnates like Mark Zuckerberg of Meta, Facebook, all look like they're breaking what Yale University professor Timothy Snyder calls rule one in his book on tyranny: don't obey in advance. The first two defy decades of traditions, pulling newspaper editorial endorsements of Kamala Harris prior to the election. And Zuckerberg lifted Facebook's ban on Donald Trump, then dined with him at Mar-a-Lago and had Meta donate $1 million to the Trump inaugural committee. These billionaires have a wide array of business interests and aren't going to jeopardize that with negative reporting. We have to continue to hold those in power accountable and at the same time be prepared to face attempts to intimidate or silence us. And that's where the power of an engaged audience comes in, demanding a genuine free press that reports without fear or favor. It's essential to the functioning of a democratic society.
I just want to thank everybody very much. I'm just telling you, this will be the golden age of America.
There was a big segment of journalists who were told that they were sort of warriors for the truth against Donald Trump instead of chroniclers of events as they happen.
Knowing helps us decide. Knowing keeps us free.
For a lot of the big publishers, who were, by the way, struggling to keep their businesses alive, that was a very promising line of business to be the resistance. And you saw, in particular, the Washington Post change its slogan to "Democracy Dies in Darkness" and sell lots of subscriptions, basically on the promise that we're standing up to Donald Trump. It's really tough to keep telling this tale of crusading journalism. Jeff Bezos and Patrick Soon-Shiong are billionaires in heavily regulated industries, space and healthcare, and so they're pivoting very hard to ingratiate themselves to the new administration. And so now lots of their subscribers are understandably saying, wait, I bought, you know, this journalism that was marketed to me to save democracy, and now you're betraying that cause.
This is just the beginning. This is just the first episode. We are just getting started.
There's also this proliferation of new voices, which is a reality that professional journalists have to reckon with.
Otherwise, you
These new guys have built an ecosystem of podcasts and YouTube channels, and they have audiences that aren't always plugged into politics. But in many ways, they've replaced the mainstream media for a lot of people. And actually, a lot of the mainstream liberal media class is essentially the butt of jokes in this online ecosystem.
Yes, hypocrisy is alive and well amongst these sanctimonious leftists. From Kimmel to De Niro to Stephanopoulos, they want you to believe they're better than you.
You know, Trump is really the reality now. And I think the way to tackle him is that we need to stay in our lane a bit more. The media for a period really liked to posture as combatants in a battle for democracy. You know, at Semaphore, we're really scrupulous about not lecturing our audience. We're trying to get away from the posturing about how media are the only true opposition to Trump. It's just not useful to anyone.
Mr. President, it's great to have
you. That was a nice introduction.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
You are a one of one.
Yeah, let's end the show right now.
Trump obviously used podcasts and that whole sphere of alternative media to great effect during the campaign. And that's a really important shift in political media and the media in general.
Your team and I want to shoot a TikTok with you.
Oh, that's good. I'm on TikTok.
It's not like the podcasters and streamers are the first of their kind to weave political commentary into non-news output. I mean, shows like Good Morning America, The View, even the late-night TV comics, they've all been doing it. But those guys have the trappings of the mainstream. There's a predictable format, sort of rehearsed pattern to the discussions. You still know very clearly when you're being delivered a political message.
Democracy dies in darkness.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, you just turned the light off again. That's why people are mad.
This Donald Trump, he's like the emperor from Star Wars. He's old, he's evil, and he keeps coming back with no reasonable explanation whatsoever.
But the thing that's different about your Joe Rogans or, you know, the Twitch streamers you might find is that their political content is kind of unrehearsed. They'll be talking about wrestling, for instance, and then they'll mix in their political opinions as part of their just natural flow of conversation.
Nobody ever heard of. And now, it took her 2 months, but you know what? All of a sudden...
Well, it caught fire.
It means that people are picking up political ideas ambiently. It's not like you tune in to Joe Rogan for a political update, necessarily. It's all kind of mixed together in a way that feels natural and unrehearsed. And I think that there are people who are bored with conventional media who find that really, really attractive.
Tonight, the high-stakes showdown here in Philadelphia between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump.
I think we have to think hard as an industry about whether the way that we're producing political information is just too staid, whether we're producing content that actually reaches people where they're consuming media. The standard print press doesn't really cut it anymore. Twitter doesn't really cut it anymore. It's dwarfed by Instagram, dwarfed by YouTube, dwarfed by TikTok, and dwarfed by these alternative media outlets that Trump has been using to such great effect. If we're stuck in the old channels of media distribution and of distributing our journalism, we're not going to reach the people who most need to hear it, the people who are only peripherally engaged with politics. Those people end up making the difference in elections. And if they're not actually being served by mainstream media institutions, they're doing the rest of the country a huge, huge disservice.
The media's tamed down a little bit. They're liking us much better now, I think. If they don't, we'll have to just take them on again.
And finally, returning to Gaza, and an image captured just over 2 weeks ago. It shows a doctor, Hussam Abu Safiya, the director of what was one of the last barely functioning hospitals in northern Gaza, Kamal Adwan. The doctor is walking towards the Israeli forces that ordered the closure of that hospital. He then disappeared into Israeli custody. Too many other Palestinian doctors have been arrested, tortured, and even killed while held by Israel. It was one of those pictures that somehow resonated with people. To explain why and how that image was seen from inside Israel, we are revisiting our interview with the Israeli journalist Donna Mills.
Every war and every genocide have an iconic image. Whether it's the Vietnam War or the Holocaust, there's always an image that pops to our mind when we remember that historical moment. The image of Abu Safiya is an image of defiance. It's an image of resistance. And especially it's an image of humanity, of moment of humanity when humanity is very, very scarce. And I think that one of the reasons this image had stuck more than others at this moment, although we are very saturated with horrible, horrible photos of starving children and children who are freezing to death, is actually its lack of graphic effect. The fact that it's not shocking in its visuality, but its content is a very deeply human moment when humanity is very, very scarce. And when I first saw the image, it made me look in the mirror in a very different way. I feel that that image, that moment of Abu Safiya, is really a moment of reckoning for all of us in Israel, all of us who are complicit in this genocide, who are taking part in it in an active or passive way every day and are complicit in it, giving away our humanity every day in silence.